Welcome, everyone, and I want to thank the play called Church 2. They allowed us to use their stage this morning, even though they've got a matinee here at 3. So I've long said it would be great if we could use the sets when presentations are going on here. So they allowed us to do that, and I'd like to let you know that 3 p.m. today, matinee show, Church 2, about the Me Too movement within the church would be great for some of us to check out if you have the time, if you haven't already seen it. I know a number of people have and have said very powerful things about it. So if you don't have anything going on this afternoon, let me know. Maybe a few will head down to the show. So I got a knock on my door the Saturday night before the very first Sunday at Nexus, and was my neighbor, very first Sunday of this season, was my neighbor, and he said, "We've got a problem." I said, "Oh, what's going on?" He said, "There's a massive hornet's nest in the trees right over in my tree, right over the sidewalk where all the children play and go by every day. It's massive. We got to do something about it." It was weird because I've walked that sidewalk so many times, I've never seen it. And he's like, "It's massive. We got a problem. So go take a look. There it is. It's huge. There's a whole bunch of hornets there." I'm like, "So what are we going to do?" He's like, "I got a plan." I borrowed a slingshot from the next door neighbor, and I've got some spray, and we're going to take it down. And he said, "Can I count on your help?" I said, "Yes, count me in. What do you want me to do?" And he said, "Well, what I was thinking is you'd be the one with the slingshot." Okay. "And you'll climb the ladder and spray it down. I'll hold the ladder." I'm like, okay, it seems like it is your tree. But anyway, I'm like, "Yes, done. I'm in. All right." He's like, "Let's do it right now." And I was like, "No, I got Nexus tomorrow. And if I get stung a whole bunch of times, I don't want to show up injured." So he's like, "Okay, Sunday, 8 p.m., dusk, meet me. We're going to take this thing down." So there we are. He had a suit for me, fully dressed, a can. I still went with the sandals, though, so a little open there against the... So I go at this thing with the slingshot, and I'm like, "What's the plan if this thing comes down?" He's like, "We're going to run, and we're going to have to go around the block because we won't be able to come home right away, so we'll run." I'm like, "Okay." So I go at a slingshot, horrible aim. I can't hit this thing. Finally, I hit it 2 or 3 times, and it causes a commotion, but nothing comes down. So then it's like, it's time to go nuclear. We've got to go up the ladder. And so up the ladder I go with the spray, and it's right above me, so I'm spraying up, and this toxic mist is falling back down on me, and Kristen and the kids are on the porch, "Get higher, you gotta get higher." I'm like, "Well, geez, I can't." So I waste this whole canister on the nest, and there's hornets falling all around me, but at the end of the day, it's still there, and it's still active. And so my neighbor Mike and I, we've regrouped. We're going to have a new strategy. I ordered a new slingshot off of Amazon. That should be arriving any day now. So we're going to go back at it. Wish me luck. But the odd thing to me was this. I walk by that place every day, sometimes multiple times a day, hundreds of times throughout the summer I've walked by it and never seen this hornet's nest once until somebody pointed it out to me. It was hidden in plain sight. And when you're familiar with something, like your walk to the park, sometimes you don't even notice something's different, something's there, unless you're coached to sort of look for it. And it reminds me of a G.K. Chesterton quote. He says this, "There's a law written in the darkest of the books of life, and it is this. If you look at a thing 999 times, you're perfectly safe. If you look at it the 1,000th time, you're in frightful danger of seeing it for the first time." And it's my hope that this might be our experience as we anchor ourselves for 3 Sundays in the book of Exodus. Exodus is, quite honestly, one of the greatest literary achievements in all of human history and one of the most well-known and important stories I think ever told. And I think this is precisely why we need to heed Chesterton's words. The book of Exodus is so familiar to many of us, too familiar. And we've strolled past it hundreds of times, but my hope is that we can see it again for the 1,000th time and to find ourselves in that, in Chesterton's words, frightful danger of seeing it for the first time. And so what is the book of Exodus about? I mean, quite frankly, on a very immediate level, it's about slavery and liberation, which of course creates a large gap between us and the book. Slavery still exists today, but most of us don't know that experience at all. For us, that's almost beyond comprehension, and yet the power of the book is this. We might not know slavery, but all of us do know what it's like to feel trapped by something. It could be depression, anxiety, could be some kind of addiction, some kind of mindset cycle, an ideology, a system. It could even be your own personality. We all know the experience of feeling trapped, feeling bound, feeling like we don't have control over our lives or our circumstances. And the primary message of the book of Exodus is that slavery to anything is not the way things should be. Slavery of any kind in any form is not the way God intended us to live in the world. And so the Exodus story is a story of hope, not of optimism, but of hope. And much like last year, I want to explore this book briefly in 3 weeks, but I want to do that using some archetypal language, masculine, feminine, which is not to say that men are like this and women are like this, not at all, but seeing story through archetypes, I think, might allow us to see the book of Exodus for the thousandth time, and in that, perhaps see it for the first time. So the story, it opens with the Hebrew people. They're living in Egypt. Their population and influence is growing. They're mushrooming as a people. And a new king, a new pharaoh emerges. He's on top of the hierarchical structure of the Egyptian empire. And he scans his empire and he sees the Hebrew people and says, there's a threat, a significant threat to me. This is his thinking in Exodus 1. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come. We must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. And so, having reached the pinnacle of power, this new king is nervous about this increasing population of Hebrews because it could become a threat to his hold on power. I mean, already the story is speaking to us. This is the problem. The challenge with power, its intoxicating effect is this: power is always paranoid, sees threats everywhere. And once you have power, the temptation is always, how can I reduce or contain other people's power and influence? And so he does this in the most curious of ways. He has two strategies. He first enslaves the Hebrew people and increases their workload. And the idea behind this strategy seems to be this. If people have to work all the time, they won't have time for sex, which means they won't procreate. This led to some really weird Google searches on my part this week. I'm a little bit embarrassed about my internet browser history, but I was like, is this a sound strategy? And so I started Googling, do busy people have less sex? Do people who work more than 60 hours a week have less sex? I kept typing all these questions. Google will give me the answers. And according to Google, this is a sound strategy. Yes, people who work all the time are really busy. They do have less sex. So, okay, maybe it's a sound strategy, but poor Pharaoh, for whatever reason, his plan actually doesn't work at all. In fact, it has the opposite effect. The Hebrew people end up multiplying even more. And so he ups the stakes. He moves to plan B, which is a sort of final solution. He calls for the massacre of all male babies, which raises the question, why male babies alone? This is where I find one of the church fathers, Gregory of Nyssa, very refreshing today. He wrote a book on the life of Moses back in the 4th century, and he sees the story as, among other things, this. It's a tale of toxic masculinity versus healthy masculinity. He sees this as a tale between unhealthy masculinity and healthy masculinity. Which again speaks to the importance of a show, a play like Church 2. And so what he says is this, essentially what the Pharaoh is trying to do here is to kill any kind of masculine virtue. He's trying to prevent the virtues of masculinity from existing because they present a threat to him. He's trying to solidify his power and ensure that masculine power becomes equated with that which oppresses. And the virtue is that which is something that might challenge the abuse of a toxic masculinity. And so what he argues is that when we see Moses in this book, we should see Moses as the birth of virtue. Healthy masculinity is possible, but it needs to be nurtured, it needs to be cultivated. And so for Nisa, there are many layers in the book of Exodus. But once you look at the story for the thousandth time, it pops out at you. The solution to toxic masculinity is virtue. And what is needed when slavery dominates, when toxic uses of power become the norm, what we need is not a competitive or a rivalrous mindset, but a mindset that sees the nurturing and cultivation of virtue as the answer to the problem. And again, we're not talking specifically about men and women here. This is something inherent in all of us. We all have a Pharaoh in us. We all have a tyrant living inside of us. And so the book, what it does is it asks of us this: what parts of us are tyrannically trying to squash or eradicate virtue? What parts of us are enslaving other parts of ourselves? What parts of us want to avoid what is good and what is true? Because the reality is, right, we sabotage ourselves. We have a Pharaoh in us. We have a tyrant in us that wants to thwart virtue. And at its worst, this becomes publicly exemplified in people like tyrants and pharaohs and people like Harvey Weinstein and people like Donald Trump, even church leaders like Bill Hybels. I'm not sure if you've followed the big church news this summer, but Bill Hybels, church 40 years, pastor of one of the largest churches in America, has faced accusations of sexual harassment. And the church tried to cover it up. It's a messy scene. He had to resign. Everybody resigned from Willow Creek. It's a massive mess. You see, this person that was held as a pinnacle of what it means to be a church leader, suddenly he realized, whoa, there's a Pharaoh inside of him that hasn't been kept in check. You know, so I'm not a huge fan of Hybels. I was talking with a friend this summer about this, and he started weeping. He said, I've looked up to him my whole life, and to see him fall apart this way, to see that church try to cover things up, it's just absolutely undid him. But we have to face this. There's a Pharaoh inside of us, and at its worst, it's exemplified in these leaders who do despicable things. But I think the impulse, oftentimes, it manifests itself in smaller ways. Smaller things, smaller impulses like gossip and lust, or just the general assumption that the world exists to rotate around us. Everyone else is just a pawn in the game that we're playing. And this impulse within us must be resisted with virtue, but how? How? The book of Exodus starts to answer this question by offering us four stories, a sisterhood of resistance, four figures who resist so that virtue can be born and nourished. The first resistors are the Egyptian midwives. Pharaoh first tasks the Egyptian midwives. Here's my plan. You're going to carry it out. This is what he says. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, when you are helping the Hebrew woman during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. And what happens next to me is absolutely hilarious. The first to resist are these midwives, and they resist through deceit, lying, and playing the trickster, which I should add, in case you've thought I forgot, is a form of pirating. Consider Jack Sparrow, the most famous pirate of our time, right? And Wikipedia describes Jack Sparrow this way. Sparrow is a trickster who uses wit and deceit to attain his goals, preferring to end disputes verbally instead of by force. A trickster is this well-known literary archetype, and generally when we encounter a trickster in a story, these characters find themselves in a position of weakness, which incidentally is a position Jesus calls us to take the mantle of, weakness. And these tricksters are often in a position of weakness, like the midwives, because power is rarely available to them. So they resort to using what I believe is an even stronger weapon, wit, intelligence, charm, and words, to subvert and pirate those who are strong and powerful. This is exactly what happens with the Egyptian midwives. It's hilarious to me. The midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." I love it. That is awesome. It's like, we wanted to, Pharaoh, but wow, this is intense. These women are vigorous. They push babies out real quick. It's a lie, but they're subverting. Trickery. Deceit. And what I love is the text says, God blessed them for their lies. Now that's some pirate theology right there. The actual moral of Scripture is tell the truth always, unless you're subverting a system with some holy mischief, in which case trickery is permitted. And it's seen throughout Scripture. If you're subverting something, a little trickery is okay. And so what does Pharaoh do? He ups the ante. Declares any Egyptian finds a Hebrew male baby should throw it in the Nile River, which is some nasty stuff. She brings us to the second resistor, Moses' mother herself. When Moses is born, she knows very well what will happen next. She knows the law. She knows where this is headed, but decides to hide Moses for 3 months. And then she builds him a little ark, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, no on the flood, puts him in it, and releases him to the waters, entrusting that God will take the virtue that she has nurtured and do something with it. And both Moses' mother and the midwives here are a very powerful reminder to all of us. I think it's this: no matter what circumstances we find ourselves in, we always have a choice. No matter how far you believe your agency has been stripped from you, no matter how weak, how powerless, how hopeless you feel, we always have a choice. Listen on a podcast this summer to the history of the Nuremberg trial, specifically Adolf Eichmann's trial. And I was fascinated by his defense, which was essentially, I had no power. I was just doing what I was told to do. I wasn't in a position of authority. I was just following orders. Yeah, but you still had a choice. You still had a choice. And you see, what Moses' mother realized is this: even under the iron fist of a dictatorship in tyranny, she has a choice to make. And this is, I think, so tough for us to internalize. No matter what it is that has enslaved us or trapped us, no matter how powerless we feel, no matter how crippled we feel under the weight of whatever it is, we always have our choices. And the idea is this, and Moses' mother exemplifies this, the midwives do, even with a gun pointed to your head, you don't have to abdicate responsibility to whoever is holding the gun. And rather than give in to despair, she makes the choice to nurture life. She takes responsibility of the little she has control over and nurtures virtue. I watched a documentary this week that just, it rattled me in a weird way. It was Tony Robbins on Netflix. Tony Robbins, I'm Not Your Guru. And I knew nothing about Tony Robbins. In fact, I had assumed he was basically like Joel Osteen, which he's not. He's mean, like, whew. And it was a documentary that followed his one-week conference. And 2,500 people pay $5,000 to attend this, which means he makes $12.5 million off of it. So the whole thing seems very dodgy to me. But I watched with fascination because, A, cracked me up. He has a little ritual before he goes on stage. He takes, like, B2 vitamin shots, and then he spins around, and then he goes out the curtain, and it's like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to try that next week. It'll spin around, and he's like motivated. There's music playing, but what he does is he teaches certain principles, kind of pop psychology stuff, and then he does interventions with people. And I was so fascinated by the way he intervened and addressed people's problems, because essentially this conference gathers together a lot of people who feel incredibly trapped. Trapped, like they have nowhere to go. And he somehow manages, I think probably it's just short term, but he manages to help them. I was particularly struck by this one married couple. This was odd to me. He stood up and they were talking, and the wife was describing her vision for their marriage, and it was beautiful and it was awesome. And then she, Tony said to the guy, what's your vision? And he looked frazzled. Like just poof, his hair's everywhere. He looked like just a beaten down man. He's like, well, I want our essence to be together. And Tony's like, stop. That's the worst answer I've ever heard. It's like, whoa. He calls this guy out. He does this whole parable thing. And then he's like, I want you to roar like a lion. And I'm watching this guy go, no way is this happening. But he starts roaring repeatedly, going nuts. His hair's everywhere. He's like, rawr. I'm like, what the heck is happening? This is a weird phenomenon. And then they follow up with them after. It's hilarious. They're like, last night we had the best sex of our lives, and we decided to have kids, and we're changing our whole life because he started roaring like a lion. I'm like, wow, this is weird, but also awesome. And like, I don't know what to make of it. And it's been rattling me, this documentary, because I'm like, what is this phenomenon? I've been thinking about it. What is Tony Robbins' power? I think it's simply this. He reminds people, you have a choice. And doing that apparently can make you a very wealthy person. You have a choice. He simply tells people, you have a choice. In one scene, he's like, you need to break up with your husband right now on the phone.
Right now on the phone.
Yep. So he calls him. You have a choice. And I think he's a bit of a dodgy fellow, but he reminds people. That's what he does, essentially, is you have a choice right now. And this is what we see exemplified in the midwives and Moses' mother. We have a choice, and we will not succumb to the tyranny. We will resist. We will nurture life and virtue. And then we'll surrender the outcome of that to God. And then there's Miriam, number three, Moses' sister. And watch her virtue here. If you read through, you must read through Exodus 1 and 2. It's just phenomenal storytelling. And when you watch Miriam here, it's interesting because God is about to echo what she does and appear under the cloak of her virtuous posture. What does Miriam do? She simply follows the ark as it's released into the water. All she does is this, waits, watches, looks for opportunity to help. She nurtures virtue simply by waiting, watching, looking for help. That's it. And this is how God is about to appear on the stage as well. And then we run into Pharaoh's daughter. She finds the basket with Moses in it. She epitomizes the exact opposite of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is blind and ignorant. She sees and she knows. Pharaoh is cruel and hardened. She is tender and kind. Pharaoh's daughter, this is what it said. Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. She sees and has compassion. That's how virtue always arrives, through vulnerable helplessness, simply waiting to be nurtured and cared for. The parallels to Jesus' birth here are absolutely staggering to me. And wait for it, because when God finally shows up on the stage, he comes as the feminine God who sees and feels compassion, ready to nurture virtue into maturity. You know, it's got me thinking. Sometimes I hear stories, particularly oftentimes from women, about how they're maligned for being emotional, for being too caring, too compassionate. And I think to myself, that's the only way the world has ever been saved, is through that. Amen. It's true. That's the only way for virtue to be nurtured, through seeing, knowing, compassion, care. And so this sisterhood, these four women, they're seen as the ones who midwife, coax into existence that of virtue. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, so what? Here's the point to me. Who is nurturing virtue in you? That's the point of the story in many ways to me. You don't mature on your own. Our own virtue requires nurturing. It requires midwifery, nurturing, compassion, care, being fed. So who is nurturing virtue in you? Who is it in your life who's calling forward the best of you? Who is it in your life is close enough to you to remind you that you can be better than that? You can be better than what you are right now. And when I talk about virtue, I'm not talking about some sort of moralism or being overly pious. By virtue, I mean living out the human reality to its fullest. I'm talking about virtue as aligning ourselves with what is eternal. I'm talking about maturing into being fully and truly alive. Who is it that's nurturing you? Who is it in your life that's willing to say to you, you're better than that? You can do better than this. That's not easy. We don't want to hear that from just anyone. I was reflecting on this, though, on Friday night. I had an old friend. I hadn't seen him in probably about 10 years. Old friend over. We were up late just chatting, and after he left, yeah, you ever have one of those moments where it's 2 a.m., you should be sleeping, you find yourself reflective, and I was just praying, and I was like, thank you, God, that I have the richness in my life of friends who coax out the best in me. Even old friends. That's a powerful thing to have, and not everybody has it. I'm not going to name names, but somebody recently here, we're close, so this wasn't just some random stranger, but they, after a sermon, said, you didn't really show up there, Brad. You weren't really giving your best there. Essentially, you can do better than that, you know it. This person was right. And it was interesting because I was telling my other pastor friends about this incident, and they're like, there's no one who would be that honest with me. Everyone just, oh, that was good, yeah, yeah. And we were talking about the poverty of that, that so many of us live our lives with nobody willing to be honest enough with us to say, you're better than that, come on. Coax out that virtue, nurture it in us, bring it out. So who is it? I'm not just talking about friends we get together with and you can laugh and gossip with and, you know, share jokes with. That's awesome. Who are the people who are like, come on, come on? Just their presence makes us want to be better. That's what we need, and that's what these four women, this sisterhood of resistance is their nurturing virtue here, preparing it. And so to Gregory of Nyssa, Moses, represents the birth of virtue, the possibility that is in all of us. And it's midwifed, coaxed into existence by these four women. And what's interesting is after Exodus sets the scene, it very quickly shifts to when Moses is older. And what we realize is as a new chapter emerges, chapter 2, we come to realize Moses has been set up this whole time to have a massive identity crisis. Like, big time. And this is his fundamental dilemma. He has to figure out who he is. He's both slave and prince, and yet he's neither slave nor prince. He's born Hebrew, raised Egyptian, and I find his identity crisis so interesting. There's a lot to unpack here. This is the interesting thing. Because he's not raised a slave, he never fully takes on the dehumanization that slavery involves. I think this is so important. As Duncan Rayburn says, it's one thing to get the slave out of Egypt. It's another thing to get Egypt out of the slave. On the flip side, he's an adopted prince of Egypt, so he never fully takes on the role of oppressor. So he lives in these two worlds. And I've come to think this is important. The ones who can truly help us find our way are those outside of camps and tribal boundaries. I'm convinced of it. And so Moses has to figure out who he is. He stands actually between two brothers in the story. His Egyptian brother will go on to be the next Pharaoh. His Hebrew brother will become the first priest. And so he's got two paths in front of him, prince or priest, vice or virtue, tyrant or mediator. And this identity crisis, it plays out rapidly in three stories. First story is this. Moses, as an adult, is walking around. He sees an Egyptian fighting with a Hebrew slave, which is really brilliant because he sees an external struggle that perfectly matches what's going on inside. His inner self, his inner brothers are fighting, you could say. And what he does is he kills the Egyptian, buries him. And so some see this as a parabolic story. Moses, this is about our own inner struggle. We have to kill the part of ourselves that's the tyrant. We must kill off toxic masculinity within us, so to speak. And that's what's asked within us. Anything that doesn't ask us to be better than who we are right now needs to die. I like that, but I actually preferred to see this episode as part of Moses maturing. And at this point, I actually see him as enacting the very worst of human nature. He sees an injustice and he acts violently. He's still under the tyranny of his own anger, his own rage. Moses is still maturing. And at this point, I would say this, he's passionate, but passionately ignorant. It's virtue undeveloped. He has passion without wisdom, passion without restraint. And this is a syndrome I know very well. I can get passionate about things and have no wisdom at all. For instance, who here has read Born to Run? Right? No? Oh, you must. It's delightful. It really set me on fire. It's a story, basically, of running. And what this book proposes is that as humans, we were born to run. And that as we evolved, what made us a superior species is that we could run and hunt down our prey over large territories. And so the book espouses the virtue of running, how it's in our human nature to run, and that we should be running essentially barefoot. We don't need all these shoe stuff. We should be running barefoot. And I read that. Before this, I had never even run, let alone thought about running. Like, I always kind of thought, that was stupid. You run around the block, you end up the same place. Like, it's just, I don't get running. But I read this book, and I'm like, I need to run. This is who I was born to be. And so I go out, and I buy these stupid shoes that have no padding, and I start my running career because I think you're supposed to be barefoot. And I start running. Some of us are in run club together. Remember, I was trying to convert you to the barefoot shoes. You were like, yeah, no. And I'm still, I got into this and I hurt myself like I always do. And I still dealing with knee things. I can't run anymore because I was like, yes, I'm going to run and onto this fad. Passionate with no wisdom. You're just like, yes, this is my thing. Jump into it. And this is exactly what's going on with Moses. Passionate without wisdom. In his fight against injustice, he becomes ruthless himself, becomes the very thing he despises. We call it, my friend Kevin calls this, ignorance on fire. I would say we see it everywhere today. There are a whole lot of passionate people today, but wisdom seems to be in short supply. So Moses has to mature. Moses must grow if he's going to take on Pharaoh, if virtue is going to conquer vice. And so Moses tries to mature, but his second attempt fails as well, even though it shows sign of maturing. What happens next is Moses encounters two Hebrews who are fighting with one another, and he's eager to not make the same mistake, so he tries to move into the mediator role. Ask them questions. What are you guys doing? He invites participation. So there's a maturing of virtue here, because at least now he's not using violence. He's not being the tyrant, telling them to stop, not using force. But the thing to me is this, virtue is not always welcome. It's not always received well. He tries to mediate between these Hebrews, and they don't take his questions well. They get very defensive. Had an encounter like that this week. Bizarre. I was having coffee with someone at Tim Hortons, and suddenly there was a kerfuffle behind us. Turn around, and from what I can piece together, what happened is a guy was leaving Tim Hortons, and there was an Indian woman with her two kids. So a mother, two kids, probably about 6 and 4. And the one of the children accidentally spilled a drink on this man leaving the store. And there was yelling, and he swore at the kids, and then apparently race got involved, and he stormed out, and there was this woman with her two kids left crying, standing there, and everyone in Tim Hortons going, and she's just crying. Why did he bring race into this? Why did he swear at my kids? And so I'm standing there, and the person I was with was like, go. I'm like, yes, I will go. And so I go out the door, and I'm going to track this guy down. I don't know exactly what I was thinking. Something inside of me wants to play the hero role. So I get on the street. I walk him, see him walking down the street. I'm like, sir, excuse me. I did. I said, sir. And he looked back and he kept walking. I said, pardon me, sir. We're going to need to have a little chat. And he keeps walking. And so I speed up my pace. All the while. Sir. And again, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, what was my intro line going to be? Christ has called me to be a minister of reconciliation. So if you have a few moments, I would like to talk to you about what just happened. And so I'm closing the gap. And finally, I'm like, sir, I need to talk to you. And he sets his drinks down. He's got earphones on. He turns around to me. He throws his earphones off, rips off his shirt, and charges up into my face like this. And I had a few thoughts in the moment, that split second. The first was this. I knew I was going to get hit. And it's very vain of me. I'm like, I hope he doesn't break my glasses, because I can't go a week without my glasses. And the second part is, I was reflecting on Glenn's teaching through his story about his annoyance with pacifists, and I was thinking about how it's really easy to be pacifist when you're weak. And instinctually, he's right up in my, with his shirt off, he's up in my face, and I gently went, I didn't come here to fight. He's like, well, it's really hard for me to tell the story without using the language he did. I'm going to edit that out. Just, there were a lot of not nice words said to me. And what's your problem? Do you want to fight? I don't want to fight. I just think that there's a woman crying with children, and we need to, and he just keeps swearing at me. And do you want to go? Do you want to go? I'm like, no, I don't want to go. You will destroy me. And you're angry. So, and I kept talking with the guy, but eventually he just was like, if you want a piece of me, come farther. We'll settle it like men. Of course, like men. Pfft, I hate guys like that, really. And I was like, all right, so my mediator role is going to take a little finessing. Didn't work out so well. And so I turned around, went back to Tim Hortons, and sat there shaking, but going, isn't that interesting? Sometimes we want to mediate and adjust. That ain't working. And this is what happens to Moses, and it crushes him. He tries to mediate, and they're like, get off your moral high horse and get out of our face. And Moses is trying to, again, to birth, coax virtue into existence, and he's been twice defeated now. He's embarrassed. His confidence is shattered. He feels exposed. He feels vulnerable. And so what does he do? He runs away into the wilderness. He avoids dealing with his internal conflict, with the battle between his two brothers, his two ways of being, but his inner turmoil won't leave him. As the old saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. And so he runs away, but conflict finds him again. Moses happens upon a group of shepherd men. They're bullying some woman. They're hogging this well. They won't let the woman shepherds come and water their flocks. So what does Moses do? He intervenes, drives them away. And in that, he's fairly successful. He drives them away, and then the text tells us, and I think this is interesting, he drives them away, and then he waters the flocks of the woman. And I think it's, again, this sort of metaphor. He is now becoming a shepherd. He tried on the mantle of the justice warrior, failed miserably. He tried on the mantle of mediator, fails. So he runs away, and he stumbles into this role of shepherd. But even in this point, he's lost. He's confused. He's not sure who or what he is. And it's in this crisis of identity that Moses will come to meet and face God. And this is where chapter 2 ends. The Hebrew people are still in slavery. Moses, the birth of virtue of self, is lost, unsure of himself, wandering in the wilderness as a lowly shepherd. And it's into this void that God takes the stage. And notice again how the chapter ends with God taking on the posture of the woman that we met, the resistor's sisters, who resisted by opening their eyes and heart. They heard, they watched over, they felt compassion for. And here is the thing, God is about to take that on as well. I want to ask the band to come as I just finished with this last piece of scripture. This is how God enters the stage. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning. And he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. And that's just where I want to leave the story. A people enslaved, looking for hope, looking for liberation. In the meantime, virtue has been birthed and nurtured and coaxed into existence, but it finds itself lost in the wilderness, confused, full of self-doubt. And you know, the reality is, I don't doubt that this is where many of us find ourselves oftentimes, trapped, our confidence broken, full of self-doubt. We feel like Moses, just lost and wondering. But that's what it means to be human. And as scripture reminds us, in our moments of self-doubt, our moments of confusion, feeling trapped or lost or unsure of ourselves, it's in those moments that then we are often open time to meeting God, hearing the voice of divinity, which is exactly what happens next. Moses is ready to grow up, to receive a profound epiphany about himself. And it's such an amazing encounter, but I want to leave that for next week. And so that's where we're going to end it this morning. We're going to continue in Exodus for the next 2 weeks. We're going to look at Moses' conversation with God. And then a final week, I want to look at the weirdest story in all of Exodus where God tries to kill Moses, which is odd, but it's going to be great. So, Ben, will you play us out, and then you'll help us go in peace after that. Anyway, thank you, friends. I hope you have a blessed morning, and take us away with little MJ.